I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Sorry for the erratic publication of shows recently. It has been a pretty crazy summer for me. In any case, I hope I can make up for that on this edition of the show with a very special guest, a man who needs no introduction, but I'll give one anyways. Dennis Kucinich, the former congressman and two-time presidential candidate, who's proven to be more than a bit of a rabble-rouser during the span of his political career. During his presidential bids, many within the sort of establishment, if you will, dismissed or ridiculed Dennis Kucinich for his views on issues like supporting marijuana legalization, same-sex marriage, opposition to the Iraq War, and much, much more. Now a lot of those views have become part of the mainstream political discourse and have gained much more traction in the Democratic Party, especially its progressive wing. He joins us on this edition of the show to discuss his new memoir, a massive tome that has been described as a cross between The Godfather and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It's entitled The Division of Light and Power, and details his fight against organized corruption during his time in city council in Cleveland, Ohio, and as the mayor of Cleveland, when he fought to save Muni Light and the city's public electrical system from the Cleveland Electrical Illuminating Company. It's a wild story that even involves an attempted assassination on Mayor Kucinich. All that and more on this edition of the program. And with that being said, let's get right into the conversation with Dennis Kucinich about his new book, The Division of Light and Power. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I've been wanting to have on the show for some time, and as luck would have it, he has a new book out, a real barn burner of a book, described as a cross between The Godfather and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Congressman Dennis Kucinich, author of The Division of Light and Power, how are you doing today?
Very well. Good to be on your show. You know, I've always appreciated the name of the show, Parallax View. Great. And this book, Division of Light and Power, shows that sometimes there can be multiple realities set side by side, and you get to choose which one you want to participate in.
I was going to say, my show is named after the Warren Beatty movie, which is sort of a conspiracy thriller from the 70s. And in a way, this book reminds me of that. I guess we'll get into that. But first, maybe you could talk a little bit about your background growing up. I know you weren't always in the highest of material positions, and what role that played in maybe the formation of your political thought.
Yeah, I mean, that's a central question. Well, I grew up in Cleveland, started at the beginning, the oldest of seven. My parents never owned a home. As the family grew, we'd find a place to rent, and then, you know, my mom would have a child, and the landlord would say, well, I rented to two, not three, and then three, not four, and four, not five. And so we just kind of bounced around from place to place, trying to find a place. By the time I was 17, we lived in 21 different places, including a couple cars. That experience of moving around certainly informed me that The city was a big place, but it also, you know, the neighborhoods in which we did live. Sometimes we were one of, if not the only, Caucasian family in a community of color where people were struggling to make ends meet. And so that experience of understanding what people go through, just to get a roof over one's head, to be able to see that food's on the table, to have all the utilities on, all those experiences were ingrained. And one experience is I've always had a lot of dogs around. Okay, thank you. Thanks, girls. Gracie, Bunny, come here.
And dogs so, are the best.
so, you know, I'm, come here. Hey, come here, baby. Come on. It's okay. So this experience of growing up among people who were having trouble making ends meet, let me tell you, it informed my politics 100%, because I've always had this great deal of sympathy for and compassion for those people who are just struggling to make ends meet. I'm not a missionary to the inner city. That's where I'm from.
Well, that actually was a good lead into another question I had. I grew up Catholic, and I feel like that's really influenced my belief in things like social justice. And of course, you've talked about this as well, Catholicism and spirituality. What role has that played in your political thought?
Central. You know, I can't say I'm a religious person, but I'm a very spiritual person. I think that that there is a spiritual dimension that surrounds all of us. And I also think there's such a thing as a soul. And when I got into politics, I was determined not to have that eaten up by various interest groups and claims by certain individuals that they had a prior right to public assets. You know, I went to Catholic school for the better part of 12 years. And the nuns who educated me, it wasn't just an education in catechism. So, you know, the basic history and rules of the church. It's about ethics. It's about doing the right thing, about whether someone's looking or not. It's about
Living a life of service in a lot of ways.
It is, totally. But service to others, not to oneself. And the opportunities are there every day for you to take advantage and when you're in public life. But I never cared about that. And the interesting thing about having the experience of growing up under, let's say, socially disorganized circumstances where, you know, there's a lot of economic uncertainty, together with the religious training and spiritual values, you know, money wasn't around. I didn't depend on money. You know, my dad did work. And he had a decent job, but with seven kids, and other problems in the family, health problems, it was just no matter what he made, it was never enough, and we were always teetering on the edge. So with that experience plus the religious education, I never, you know, while I could appreciate what money can do, I never relied on money to be happy. No one could ever give me anything material, and that made me happy. My values were in other stores. My treasures were in another place. And they were about, you know, doing the right things. They were about courage and integrity and about, standing up and being charitable, you know, to others. And And so, you know, to repeat your question again, I will say that, there's no question that the spiritual education I had informed everything that I was doing. I'm not a goody two shoes. I'm not holier than thou. I'm just someone who went into public life and I was asked to do things that I felt were fundamentally wrong. And I didn't go along with them again because, you know, I didn't want anything.
Now, I'm still working through the book. It's a pretty mammoth tome and I'm really enjoying it so far. But with regards to since we were talking about spirituality and Catholicism, I kept thinking about a New Testament quote
while reading this, and it's that quote where it said that it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. You are sort of one of these people that have gone up against, you know, power and money. And you did that going up against the people trying to take down Muni Light. Maybe you could explain just the outline of this story, trying to save Muni Light or Cleveland Public Power.
Okay, two things. First of all, I want to respond to the first observation you made. You know, people are wealthy, have their own set of problems. And those problems, you know, there's the lesson, I think, of the scriptures was that the materiality that you carry with you can bind you to, can bind you, literally, can straitjacket you. Now, the battle for Muni Light started, and the book opens up, the Division of Light and Power opens up, as you know, in a story about a blackout in downtown Cleveland. And I had just been elected to city council at the age of 23. I called Muni Light, which the guy answers the phone, Division of Light and Power, because that's the name of Muni Light. And it's also, of course, the title of the book. And he told me, you know, that all the lights were off and they couldn't have a backup because CEI, the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, was stalling on providing an interconnect, which would connect the city system with theirs in the event of a power failure. So the city was at the mercy of its own and any failures in its own equipment. Meanwhile, CEI was lobbying the Cleveland City Council to block repairs to the city's equipment. So it would be vulnerable. And they were also dragging their feet on creating any kind of an interconnection between CEI and the city. So if there was an outage, the city could turn to them for power. The city went to try other places outside Cleveland to try to get power. CEI blocked them from getting it. They talked to other power companies and said, don't let Muni Light come through your area and bring power in from another area. And those other power companies agreed to block us. We then were forced to buy emergency power from CEI, who charged the city of Cleveland triple what they charged anyone else for emergency power. So they set forth a plan to take us over. I arrived on the scene as a councilman at the exact moment they're executing that plan. And as I found out what's happening, I take the reader by the hand to see everything that's happening. And they see the lobbyists interfering with the workings of a city power system. They see lawyers who are giving the city bad advice so the municipal power system gets in trouble. They see bankers who deliberately caused the city to overborrow so the city becomes financially vulnerable. They see organized crime enter into the picture with assassination attempts. You know, when I began the campaign to save the municipal electric system, there was a high-powered rifle shot that missed my head by a fraction of an inch. And I'm, you know, talking to you from the home where that happened. So this is a book about corporate espionage, corporate sabotage, interference with the operations of a city's municipal electric system, about how the private company created blackouts on the Muni system, how they tried to take it over and lowball the bid for $88.1 million. And the city was going to sell a system worth $250 million. And I stood in the way. I started the campaign. When council and the mayor then finally executed the sale, I created a referendum that blocked the sale. We put 30,000 signatures on the desk. I became a candidate for mayor, got elected on a promise to save the system, block the sale with my election. And that's when the next part of the story happens.
In regards to your campaign to save Muni Light, what other social forces played a role in bringing to light all of this corruption, whether we're talking about activists or, you know, the media? Well, did you have any help?
Well, I had help from the United Auto Workers, notably. The media, all on the wrong side. The media was getting advertising dollars from the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company. And they not only didn't report what the dirty tricks that CEI had committed, But their editorial offices, there was steady traffic between executives of CEI and the media, where CEI was just writing stuff and getting it published verbatim in the media as a result of their close connection through advertising. So the book describes how the media let down the people of the city. And we organized at a neighborhood level. It was people in neighborhood after neighborhood, with the help of the United Auto Workers, who enabled us to mount the campaign, to have a petition drive that was successful. It blocked the sale. It should have created a referendum, but city council did everything they could to scuttle the referendum. It ended up in court. And by that time, I became mayor. So the key moment comes when the biggest bank in Ohio tells me, hey, you've got to sell that electric system or we're not going to renew the city's credit on loans I hadn't even taken out. And I knew that default meant they're going to smear the city for till kingdom come. And I also knew that it was, you know, would probably finish me off in politics. But we had a meeting on December 15th, 1978, with the biggest bank in town. They made the offer. They said, you can have $50 million with the new credit, and we'll renew the loans if you sell Muni Light. But if you don't, you're going into default. So, you know, I said no, and because it wasn't mine to sell. As far as I was concerned, that light system belonged to the people, and the bank had no business trying to extort it. And the moment was one where I was either going to stand up for the people's right to have an electric system or give it away. And all the media was saying, hey, sell Muni Light or you're going to go into default. They didn't even understand what was going on. Or if they did, they deliberately and corruptly ignored it. And the book tells this whole story. The Division of Light and Power tells a story that maybe has never been told from the perspective of anyone inside City Hall, and particularly a mayor.
So that actually is a good lead-in for a kind of pointed question I had. And that's, you know, when you see all of this going on from the inside, how does corruption take so much root to the point where, you know, government and the media and, you know, these various institutions that are designed to serve the people end up serving other interests instead? What's the machinations behind that?
Doesn't happen overnight. I mean, it becomes normalized. It becomes normalized when politicians start to sit down with lobbyists and lobbyists buy them dinners or give them tickets to baseball or football games or special events. It becomes normalized when a private company will give somebody's relative, public official's relative a job. You know, there's millions of different ways it becomes normalized. And then from generation after generation, new people come into the system. They don't even understand that you know, this system should be there first and foremost to serve the people and not to serve the interest groups. So I will tell you that, you know, you hear talk about, well, we got to get young people in politics. If they don't really understand that the way things are can and must be dramatically changed, they get brought into a system and they just become another casualty of the normalization of corruption.
In regards to what you mentioned earlier, the assassination attempts, and I know that's a juicy part of the book, so we'll let readers get into that, but how did that first come to light and what was your reaction to it?
Well, I had this high-powered rifle shot through my window, or actually went through the wall, and it missed my head by a fraction, and I didn't understand what that was about. I just reported it, and that was recorded in the media. Police came and dug the shell out of the wall in the back of the house. And then when I was elected mayor, there were a series of incidents that occurred, which I relate. I asked the head of police intelligence, well, and then I was informed by police intelligence that through the Maryland State Police, they found out that there was an assassination plot. I asked the head of intelligence, what's this about? And he said, look, it's all about the electric system. You're stopping some people from making a lot of money. So later on, and I never talked about this publicly, by the way, because I just did not want to create some atmosphere of fear and terror and everything in the city. Nah, you know, I just did my job and let the police do theirs. And so I had, you know, an extra detail protecting me. I had to wear a bulletproof vest at all times. I had to wear a bulletproof vest throwing out the opening pitch at the Cleveland Indians game in 1978. Later on, the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Organized Crime in the Midwest exposed the organized crime plot that was aimed at trying to take me out. And it makes for a fascinating reading. But I'll tell you, I wasn't aware they had that documentation. Again, I didn't say anything to anybody. A newspaper, NBC News, a news reporter interviewed someone who was a convicted hitman who claimed that he was, you know, going to do the job, and then he was picked up. Yeah, I mean, it's a dangerous atmosphere. And you have to remember, in Cleveland at that time, in the mid-70s, Cleveland was known as the bombing capital of America. And you had many factions of the mob competing with each other for control of the rackets, you know, whether, you know, it was loan sharking or gambling or prostitution, drugs, you name it. Cleveland was right in the mix of it and had a very active presence of organized crime, which was also connected to City Hall. When I got elected, I cut those ties. And that, you know, was also problematic.
It's interesting, too, because this shadowy convicted hitman, when asked about all of this from this NBC TV investigative reporter, he said, "We can't buy Kucinich. That's what I was told. We can't buy Kucinich." And that was in response to a reporter asking him, "Well, why would these people want to do the mayor in? So why couldn't you be bought off?"
Because I don't want anything. I mean, you know, I'm a happy guy. I don't need even the thought of it just doesn't register with me. It's like, well, somebody wants to give me some. I don't need anything. I didn't need a bag of chili peppers that a lobbyist tried to give me when I first came into council. Like, what's that about? You know, I get paid. That's okay. You know, when you're a representative, you get paid for it. So, you know, what more do you need? And so I wasn't raised to think that, and first of all, I didn't feel even I was entitled to anything. I just am not that enamored of materiality, which is, and you know, you have to remember that when I grew up, I mean, my parents were getting done letters all the time from bill collectors. You know, we had so many people coming to the doors looking for money. I thought they were relatives. You know, we were evicted a few times, had our stuff carried out by sheriff deputies, our furniture on the sidewalk, people, you know, not much, but they were picking through our goods, you know, and I never just got anchored to the material world. So when somebody says they're going to do something for me, I don't need it. I was probably the wrong guy for them to tell, well, you've got to do that. You know, if you do this, we'll give you this. Because just based on my ethical training and, you know, my personality, I don't need anything. But don't try to push me around. And if I represent the people, you can't tell me what I have to do. I'm going to do whatever I have to do to represent the people who put me there. And so when people start delivering ultimatums, wrong guy, you know, I'm just not the guy to do that to. Not because I'm any smarter than anyone, any tougher than anyone, just kind of ornery.
It's interesting because I'm glad you brought up the issue of not being anchored by wanting material things, because what you said earlier, that we sort of become binded by, you know, material interests at times, that's very true. And I think there's a certain freedom in not being binded to, you know, the quote unquote rat race. Could you comment on that a little bit? Listen,
I'm not opposed to having material comfort. It's okay. I mean, it's nice, you know, but I don't require that to exist. You know, when you sleep in a car as a kid, fine. You don't really think about it as being so bad, by the way. But these things become kind of normalized. And so, you know, I've always felt that I suppose I've had a more spiritual approach to life. I just happened to go into politics, which is kind of an odd place to practice spiritual values.
So before closing out, I just had maybe two more questions. The first, as a person who grew up very much admiring people like yourself, Senator Mike Gravel, a lot of other politicians that I think really stood up against power, what would you say to young people that are very fired up and interested in social change? What should they know about the political arena?
First of all, get involved. We need young people to come in, but don't sell out. Don't go to anyone for permission. If you want to get involved, go right to the people. You know, don't go to a political party. Don't go to any interest group at all. Go right to the people. They're the ones who give you permission to serve. And try to expand the base of your financial support. That's why the internet's so great. You can raise money over the internet from a group of friends to help you get started. These interest groups glom on to politicians like leeches, and they suck out your blood and sometimes parts of your soul. And you have to be careful about that, because early on, someone will say, oh, yeah, you want to be a councilman? Well, come here. Let me tell you how to do it. And by the way, I'd like you to do this development or that development or pass this bill or that bill. Oh, sure. OK. No. The minute someone starts a discussion about public policy and they have a contribution on the table at the same time, get out of the room. Leave. Once you give up your integrity, you can never get it back. And that is probably the key thing to go into public life with and to exit with. And, you know, I speak with, 54 years of experience. I feel like I'm living in a time machine and I'm still at it. I mean, I'm still involved in the public life of my community. And if you're young, yeah, you can make a difference. You don't need to serve an apprenticeship. Go for it. And don't be discouraged. Don't listen to anybody who discourages you, because if you start to drink in that discouragement, it's like poison. You won't be able to stomach it for too long. So, I've been very fortunate in that, I've been able to survive this crazy career of mine, not without some costs, as I write about in the book. But, what I feel right now is that the existence of our democracy in and of itself at every level depends on people getting involved and being aware. You must be aware. This book will open up people's eyes to what actually happens inside government and how it is possible for one person to make a difference. And, and I didn't come from a political family. No one in my family had any money, or those who did never talked about it. And yet, as one person, I just started knocking on doors. I didn't know anything and didn't know anyone about politics. That's how I learned, going right to the people. So, I really appreciate being on the Parallax View, and your questions have been excellent. And I appreciate you passing the word to your viewers to get that book, The Division of Light and Power, and to find out how that book, is changing the lives of individuals and changing communities.
I just wanted to, and this can be brief, I just wanted to get your take really briefly on, I think in a lot of ways, American politics has caught up to a lot of your viewpoints. There's more talk about the need to legalize marijuana. We have same-sex marriage now. There's more support for ending the forever wars, transgender rights. You've been supportive of all these things. What does it feel like to have sort of witnessed the sea change in American political culture?
Well, it we're going in the right direction on a number of these things. That's true. And, people have said again and again, that I've been ahead of my time. Well, I would say this is our time. And this is when we need to use every talent and ability that we have to change our politics and change our social and economic structures. There's a lot that can be done, and the change can happen like that. So I'm glad to see we're moving in the right direction. And anyone who is interested, read the book and you'll see why.
Well, thank you again, Dennis Kucinich, for coming on Parallax Views. And I hear you're running for mayor again, so if anyone's living in Cleveland, get out and vote.
Thank you very much.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dennis Kucinich. If you liked our little chat, then consider picking up his new memoir. It's a real barn burner, The Division of Light and Power. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.